Okay, so we have roughly 20 minutes left until the end of this conference. And I would like all invited speakers to come to the podium, and then the audience can ask questions to the invited speakers for 15 to 17 minutes, and then I will make a few last remarks, and this will be it. Thanks. So, invited speakers, please. That includes you as well. Okay, audience, please ask your questions.
Is it working? Okay. Thank you very much for the very interesting talks. I had a question regarding the similarities between languages. So many of the talks here suggested that similarity between L1 and L2 can facilitate the acquisition of L2 and sometimes can maybe lower the attrition of L1 in the cases of attrition. But have any of you encountered the examples for the opposite? So when the similarity between languages actually causes more interference and then inhibits acquiring some of the aspects of the L2 or maybe cause more attrition of the L1. So this is the other side.
So the question is, how does relatedness between the L1 and the L2 affect acquisition or loss?
Okay, shall I try to give it a first shot? Well, I think you need to define what you mean by similarity. First, there is actual similarity at the grammatical or featural level. Then there is something like global typological similarity, and then there's psychotypological similarity. And I think you find effects of similarity and dissimilarity at all levels. So what I've found in my research on very advanced second language learners for German is that, contrary to my expectations, the Dutch learners I tested were always worse than English or Russian learners who came from sometimes different typological backgrounds. And I think this is to do with a large degree of perceived similarity between the languages, which doesn't actually hold true at the level of the individual grammatical construction you're looking at or particular feature or properties of the grammar. So I think that the perceived similarity similarities between languages overall can have a huge impact on how difficult or easy it might be to acquire particular aspects. And an overall perceived similarity might be more of a hindrance than a help towards acquiring language, and might also lead to an accelerated loss of these particular properties, while overall language similarity might be more of a help than a hindrance to learners.
The
effects in languages that are different, where the two things are different. So I think it matters a lot at which domain of language you look at. If you look at abstract kind of grammar phenomena, I don't think the surface similarity matter a lot.
Yeah. Of course, there are other opinions.
Not about that. So this is a question for Rachel, but first let me say that thank you to all of you. It's been fantastic listening to all the great talks. But the question for Rachel, with regards to the kids like Carlos and Shauna, could you speculate on how their L2 acquisition would go? Suppose these kids are exposed to another language, let's say another sign language, right? Would they look any different than what they look like right now in their ASL? Right, particularly what I'm thinking about, you and I have had these discussions, there are folks entering the U.S., for instance, who come from very similar backgrounds as the ones that you have described, perhaps with less, more like Carlos, let's say, that are now learning ASL as well as English. And I'm wondering what you think about, if you could speculate what their path for ASL would look like.
So it's really interesting that you should ask this question. And I think that a year ago I would have said, I'm not sure that they could learn a second language, although they certainly are learning to read and write words, single words, and recognize them, which is a second language of sorts for them. It's not sign. But we actually, one of the people that we tested recently, whose data I didn't share with you, is a man from Mexico who had no sign until he was 22 and managed to escape from his, he managed to find his way to a school for the deaf. He realized he needed education, and he actually learned a bit of Mexican Sign Language, and then he made his way to the United States. And he now uses primarily ASL. He learned ASL, and when we look at his ASL, what's really interesting is that his ASL has the same characteristics as Shauna and Carlos, which is to say that it's primarily simple sentences, short sentences, a lack of grammatical morphology, no embedding. So with what they have, so looking at this particular individual, I would say that if you have something, then you can, that provides a base for you, the foundation for you to acquire something else. I think that maybe what these kids are telling us is that that's one of the things that your first language does for your second language, which is that if you have pretty complex first language, then you have a chance of being complex in your second language, that something has to grow and coalesce in terms of morphosyntactic and lexical structure, probably at an early age, and then that can be used across languages, unless you're learning them both simultaneously.
Great, thank you.
I wonder if you could talk about the relation that you see between brain and behavior. So some of you find that there's equivalent behavior in different groups, but different underlying brain mechanisms. Some of you find different behaviors that seem to be subserved by different brain mechanisms. And I wonder if which of you might have an overall take on the brain behavior relationship.
Can I take a stab at that question? I think that one thing that is really interesting is that if you look at children who have early brain damage, one of the things that we know about brain damage in language is that if the young child experiences a perinatal stroke or postnatal stroke, or in fact has to have a hemispherectomy due to intractable epilepsy, we see that there are parts of the right hemisphere that actually can just jump right in. And so that, and when we have brain damage, we see the marvelous flexibility of the brain And that I don't see any reason why, if the brain shows that kind of flexibility in the face of brain damage, that that wouldn't also be true for second language learning and first language learning. It seems that, in fact, to me, at some level, neural processing and language is not unlike trying to get your computer to do something. There are like multiple paths to get there. And I think that the brain, to some extent, operates that way. And I think that actually that fits with the notion that language is so inherent to human beings, it's so vital and critical to human beings, that our brains will find whatever means and pathways it can to engage in linguistic behavior with other human beings.
Does everyone agree on this?
yes. Okay, well, the relationship between brain and behavior is very complex, but what I think we can say is that to be cautious, for getting to the same outcome, you could follow very different paths. I mean, it's like when you read, you can read through many different paths, and so when you, you know, learn a second language, or when you read, or when you speak or listen, you can do it in very different things. Well, we are seeing, and, you know, yesterday I was during dinner talking with Vincent Gracco, and he told me that they are finding the same thing that, for instance, we are seeing in MRI when we compare the brain activation for simultaneous and sequential learners, or, you know, early and late learners. The difference, the main difference, or one of the main things that are very relevant, is that the amount of brain activation for late learners is much higher, even though they use the same, they can use the same network. Is the brain activation is much higher, more extensive for late learners than early learners. So, yeah, I mean, I'm happy with the idea that you can reach the same outcome. If you work hard, you are very proficient, but you get to the same behavior with very different brain mechanisms, or using the same mechanism, but on top of that, other mechanisms.
I'd like to first of all say that I've really enjoyed the conference. I'm not a linguistics person. I spent the first day not understanding what ERP and N400 and all that was. Gradually got a better sense of it, so the presentations made more sense gradually. I'm a language learner, and in the last 10 years I've been learning four or five languages. When I learn a language, the biggest challenge is vocabulary accumulation, because that enables me then to interact at more intense and deeper levels in the language as a listener, a reader, and a speaker. Some words you can learn right away, and some words you can study them, you can try to cram them into your head, they don't stick. Very often, some of the more basic words, colors, numbers, are very difficult, whereas some of the supposedly rarer words stick very easily. Is there a reason for why certain words stick? And this is a very non-professional technical question, but I'm curious. Why do some words stick and some don't?
Well, if I may, I think that often we have a very simple notion of the lexicon. We think it's one word, one meaning, one form, one meaning, but actually there are whole sets of words that are part of a system. So a number system is a part of a system, how you do tens, twenties. Also scalar implicatures, is something hot, is it something cold, is it all, is it most, is it some? So that there are certain sets of words that don't have a one-to-one meaning, but actually participate in an entire system. And I would predict that these particular kinds of words are harder to learn, because you have to learn how each particular language is carving up this particular logical and semantic space, in addition to learning the meaning of the word. So I think that that's one area that we might think about where lexical learning would be quite hard.
Now comes the big question. In 30 seconds or less. No, I'm just kidding. I would like to really know what each of you, because all of you talked about very different aspects of bilingual research, and I'd like to know what each of you thinks the most critical question is next to address in your research. Quickly, in a brief synopsis, like, what do you think is the most critical question that needs to be addressed next from your perspective?
How the bilingual brain works.
So what did we say? I said individual differences. So I think the way we've dealt with bilingualism or second language acquisition is to make them a very special population. I would ask that question already with respect to monolingualism, if it even still exists. So to have a more diversified view on what makes us different, maybe it's almost a philosophical question, but a relevant one. And if you think about the results that Eric presented and I try to get at, this is going to be, for me, a very critical question. But that's my personal opinion.
I would like to concur with that, but add to that that we need to really reach out beyond discipline boundaries, because some of us, like myself, have explored variation within the context of the linguistic system and the kind of learner internal factors that might contribute to variation in learning paths as well as learning outcomes. But I think we're beginning to realize more and more that it's not enough to look within the linguistic system. We need to go and look beyond that and look at environmental factors, at non-linguistic cognitive factors, and try to explore their interactions. So in a way, I think we really need to move beyond generalizations and look at individual differences, and therefore embrace the complexity of our research object in order to come up with more adequate answers for what makes for differences between populations, as well as for fundamental similarities between different populations of language learners as well as language losers.
And I, of course, agree as well with everything that you guys just said, and would add to that just bringing this idea of individual differences into some neuroimaging techniques and taking better consideration of individual differences in neuroanatomy and maturation of the brain. And there are some interesting new techniques that are starting to emerge. I think of the work of Ed Fedorenko and others who are doing these very fine-grained analyses, taking into consideration individual variability in brain structures. And that, combined with all these other factors, I think is a really powerful next direction.
I think for me, one thing that we look at clinically and that we need to look at a lot more is intervention and ways to help bilingual children and trilingual children learn more quickly and more efficiently. And so I think that there are very, very few intervention studies published that deal with bilingual children. And so we know quite little about what is the ideal way to learn or to stimulate bilingual development. And I think that has huge implications also for theories. So look at that.
I agree, of course, with everything that Holger said and Eric and Ellen. And Sonia. I think the point of what I wanted to say today was we also don't understand the normal first language acquisition process in general. We also need, looking at what Eric is doing, looking at different variables in just monolingual development is also important, to go beyond language and to integrate other disciplines as much as possible, because here we're interested a lot in the science, but there's a lot of implications for what we do, for clinical practice, for education, for language policies, and sometimes we need to pay more attention to the impact of our work beyond the science and into society more broadly.
Well, of course, I agree with everything that was said before.
That's the first time.
But there are three other things that I'm also interested in. So three separate people in me. One would be the theory of language and the theory of grammar, which is just a theory of the monolingual grammar. I think we need a theory of grammar that incorporates the bilingual grammar. So, if you look at theories of generative theories or whatever of grammar, they are all about you know, they talk about one particular language. And they need to deal with this issue of people having two grammars, right? And that another issue that is almost a philosophical question. What does it mean to be native in a language? Mm-hmm. What does that mean? I don't expect that I get an answer to that in my lifetime, but I think this is an interesting question to ask. And the third person in me would say we need a neurocognitive model of the bilingual grammar. You know, I still think that grammar is the core of language, and a lot of bilingualism research is about words, cat and mouse and dog. And people develop models of bilingualism on the basis of that, and we need need neurocognitive models of bilingual grammar. Yeah.
Is there anything left?
I don't know what's left. I agree with all of my my esteemed colleagues. I do think that we don't have adequate theories of language. We don't have adequate theories of language structure, and we don't have adequate theories of language structure in the brain. And I think that, and how, and individual differences mm-hmm. combined. And if we knew that, maybe we would be in a better position to, I also agree with Ellen that we really need better means of teaching language because there's a great need to teach language. And what is the most efficient way to teach language, and how do individual differences articulate or interact with the best ways of learning language?
Yeah, I'm not going to disagree with them. Basically, I think it will be interesting to know about what is in the brain, when it's monolingual or bilingual, what the brain connectivity differences are between bilinguals and monolinguals. And the other interesting question that was mentioned about individual differences, what is it that it makes you a good learner or a bad learner? Yeah.
Okay, excellent. Thank you all for interesting questions and interesting answers.